Yes.
And the next speaker is Lynn. Lynn, I'll hand over to you. Thank you for coming along.
Thank you, Bernie. My name's Lynn, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. I can remember years ago I went to the Big Book study for the first time, and I can remember Joe introducing himself as a very grateful recovered alcoholic. And he explained that because for me I still say recovering because I still think I've got a long way to go on this journey. But, you know, Joe was saying that we're not the people we were. We're not the people we were when we were drinking, and that's what the meaning of recovered is. And he was saying nowhere in the Big Book does it talk about recovering alcoholics. It's recovered. You know, the word they use is recovered. And I kind of thought, yeah, you know, I'm not the person I was when I was drinking. I've come a long way, but I've still got things that I need to deal with on a daily basis. So I'm never going to be 100% perfect, and I don't want to be. I want to live my journey and, you know, come across the things that God sends me on a daily basis to deal with. My journey started, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was an alcoholic, but it was never recognised. He was a heavy drinker. He had an accident when I was 6 weeks old, and my guess is alcohol was involved in that. He was on the back of a motorbike and they ran into a stationary car. So in my book, that's not a normal thing to do. I know it happens, but the chances are drink was involved that day. And my dad was disabled after that, so I didn't see a lot of drinking. I saw the personality of the alcoholic, and, you know, there were weeks sometimes when my mum and dad wouldn't speak to each other. They'd speak to us, you know, tell your dad his dinner's ready, tell your mum I don't want it yet. And it was like that, and that was like normal for us. You know, there were lots of arguments. My dad was a very angry man, a very good man, very loving man, but he had the personality of an alcoholic, and he didn't have what I've found. He didn't have Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't even know he was an alcoholic. And so, you know, I grew up in with fear to some extent, and also shame. My dad was very shame-based because of his accident, because of his disability. Didn't think he was good enough. You know, he was an Irishman in this country and didn't feel, particularly after his accident, that he was a good enough father, a good enough husband. We didn't have a lot of money, and that was just the way things were for us. But we were, in some ways, you know, my sister and I today, we don't have the best relationship, but we know that we love each other. You know, it was a sort of thing that was not spoken about, I suppose, in our family. So I started drinking when I was 14, not because of my dad's drinking, not because you know, I was running away from anything in particular. I don't know how I started drinking. I don't know how I found it. My dad always drank, had the odd Guinness and stuff like that, and so I was probably weaned on Guinness. But I don't know, and I don't care how I started. I just know I did. But I know as soon as I did start, it gave me self-confidence. It gave me self-worth. It gave me the ability to feel part of, which is something I'd never really experienced before. I was always there, but I didn't feel like I belonged. And alcohol just took that away. I don't think it ever made me feel like I fitted in. In my head it did, but really it didn't. It just made me feel like I could be. And I drank alcoholically straight off. I never drank the odd drink. I loved the effect of it. I loved the taste of it. I loved what it did for me. And I had consequences straight away. I mean, when I was about 15, 16, I can remember being in a park in Chesham where I grew up and hanging onto a railing. People were saying to me, come on, we've got to go home. And I didn't want to go home. And I had long hair in those days and I vomited. And I can remember getting home and my mum, I thought she was trying to drown me. I had to wash my hair before I went to bed because there was vomit in it. So straight off, you know, I had consequences. It was there for me. And it never got better. It just got worse. And I was a nursery. I trained to be a nursery nurse, so I was working with children, babies. And at the time when I first went to AA, I was 20 years old. I was working at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, and I was working plastic surgery in Burns as a nursery nurse on the ward. And I was in a dysfunctional relationship, another one. And I didn't find AA because I thought I had a drinking problem. I rang the Samaritans, as you do when you're 20, you know, in the middle of the night. saying that I wanted to kill myself because this relationship was not going anywhere and I didn't know what to do about it. And I told this woman on the phone a bit about me, and she said, perhaps Alcoholics Anonymous could help. You know, I obviously must have mentioned the drinking, or was probably drunk when I was talking to her. And so I didn't go to AA because I thought I had a drinking problem. I went there because I thought it was going to help me solve this relationship. So a couple of days later, this lady rang me up. I can't remember her name today. I've got a feeling it was Eileen, but I don't know. And she said, do you want to go to a meeting? And I thought, of course I do, you know, because if this is going to help me with this relationship, I'll go. So she came to pick me up in this little blue Mini, and she took me to St John's Hospital. Now, I was working at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, so I knew all about St John's Hospital in Aylesbury. It was a psychiatric hospital. And I can remember driving into the drive. This was the first time I'd ever gone near this hospital because, you know, there were mad people in there. And just before we went in, she said to me, now, you may hear the word God mentioned. And I thought, no, you know, this is not the right place for me. You know, I was brought up an Irish Catholic, convent school, religion rammed down my throat, benediction on a Wednesday, you know, going to church, doing all the stuff you have to do, going through confession, going through communion, all these kind of stuff. And I was terrified of God because, as far as I was concerned, you know, if you did bad things, he was watching, you'd go to hell. And that was it. So that was my, you know, thing about God. It was more of a God of fear that I'd grown up with. And, you know, the nuns, I mean, they'd get you by the chin. Vicious people, actually, nuns. You know, and you, I can remember being whacked for, you know, it was just like, it was not a very nice way to learn about God. So when she said this outside the psychiatric hospital, I was thinking to myself, if it wasn't so far, I'd say no thank you. But I didn't want to have to walk all the way back to Stoke Mandeville. So I thought, no, I'll go, you know, what can I do? So in I went. And I can remember the chair, the first chair I ever heard. It was an American guy, and he was in the forces over here. He's at Upper Hayford. And that meant something to me, because that's where my dad had his accident in Upper Hayford. So that was kind of like a strange thing to hear as soon as I went into this meeting. And this bloke, he was a man. He was married. He was an alcoholic. He talked about wife beating. And so there were lots of differences. And they'd said at the beginning of the meeting, look for the similarities. And I'd been in a relationship where I'd been beaten, that was very violent. That was an alcoholic relationship. I was in a relationship with a violent alcoholic. So I could identify a lot with what he was actually saying. But more than that, when I started to listen to the other people sharing, by the time I left that meeting that night, I knew I was an alcoholic. I was 20 years old, and I knew I was an alcoholic. And so I took on board, it was a day at a time, I took on board the fact that it was the first drink that does the damage. If I didn't drink that, then I wouldn't get drunk. And I took on board the fact that I needed meetings to help me because, you know, working in a hospital, I'd never seen recovery from alcoholism, and I certainly didn't know anything about it. I really had no idea what alcoholism was. Didn't know that I'd grown up with it, didn't know symptoms of it. I knew nothing about it. But in that meeting that night, I understood, you know, because I knew I was doing those things already that these people were talking about. So that night I went home and I thought, right, you know, I'm not going to drink. And I went to meetings. I came to meetings in Oxford. In those days, there weren't that many young people in AA. I can remember meeting another girl and swapping numbers with her and stuff and, you know, listening to her story. I really, really liked AA, and I was very proud of the fact that I'd now found something that I felt like I fitted into. So I went to meetings, but then, of course, you know, my sick thinking started. I didn't have a car. I was dependent on people coming to pick me up, and they did. That wasn't a problem. But time was a problem. So I reckoned that, you know, I'd actually found this out very young. I was very lucky that I'd found out that I am an alcoholic and that I can't drink. So I thought, well, these old fogies, of which I am now one, of course, they need to go to these meetings because they didn't find out, as young as I have, about this illness. They were just unlucky. So because I've now found out, I know what to do. All I have to do is not drink and I'll be fine. So I kind of tailed off the meetings. And it was probably no surprise to anybody else. But to me, it was a huge shock. You know, we had a party in the flat where I was living at Stoke Mandel Hospital, and I didn't know how to be at a party sober. I know one thing, I did not want to drink that night. I did not want to have a drink. I wasn't missing it. I'd even started to see the changes in myself, you know, the decisions I was making. I was acting like a sober person. I wasn't a nutter anymore doing these ridiculous things. And I was really proud of, you know, the changes that I was making. I could see the difference in me, and I really liked that. So I didn't want to drink that night, but I didn't know how to be at a party sober. I was just like a fish out of water. I was so uncomfortable, and it was in my flat. And I didn't know that it would be okay to say to people, look, could you clear off now because I've had enough? I can't be around this. So I thought the only thing I could do to get through that evening was to have a drink. But the next day, I'd stop, I'd get back on track, and everything would be fine again. But of course it wasn't. I drank that night. I woke up the next morning with some bloke in my bed that I didn't know. You know, all the madness was back in one evening, just one evening of drinking, and it was all there in front of me again. And I was so sad and so ashamed. All I could do to get rid of that feeling was drink. So I'm lucky to be alive because that drink lasted me 10 years. I went on drinking on and off for the next 10 years. I went back to AA several times over that 10 years. I started doing the geographicals in that time, the things I'd heard about at the meetings that I'd started to not identify with, people talking about geographicals, people who'd been to prison. I'd started looking for the differences in those meetings instead of similarities. And then I found myself in those situations. I got convicted for theft. You know, I was at another hospital. I did a geographical to Bristol. I was working in a hospital there. And, you know, I couldn't drink the way I was drinking. I couldn't afford to. I didn't earn that kind of money. It kind of culminated. Some money I did have, I lent to somebody, they couldn't pay it back. So I then started to get into a real mess. I'd get my salary every month. You know, I'd pay back what I owed. And then I would start drinking again. And by halfway through the month, I had no money. And it was just like... So I saw some social security checks, you know, a few of them, in one of these pigeon holes, you know, the nurses where we used to pick up our post. And I thought, well, she obviously doesn't need these. If she did, she'd be collecting them. So, you know, in my mind, it wasn't, you know... So stupidly, I took them to a post office of Aylesbury because I still had friends back in Aylesbury. And cashed them, you know, forged the signature on the back, cashed them. And one day, by this time I'd moved back down, I was living somewhere else, I was nannying now. It's a big house with a big, big drive, you know, a very posh place. And one day the police turned up on the doorstep looking for me. And I was like, horrified, you know. I wasn't brought up like that, you know, my lovely Irish Catholic family, that they weren't into theft, they weren't into the lies, they weren't into all that shit. You know, we didn't have money, and so they didn't steal it, we just didn't have money. So when they turned up, they took me to the police station, they fingerprinted me and went through all this stuff. And of course the only thing I could do was to drink my way through that. So on the way home that night, I went via the country lanes. I was living in Albury in Tring now, and the Bunny Club, there was not too far away from where I lived. And I was going to go home, but I thought better of it. I thought, no, this is 2 o'clock in the morning by this time. I thought they'll know I'm drunk, you know, as if they were sitting in the doorway waiting for me. So I decided I'd drive off down the lane and, you know, just sober myself up a bit before I went home. But unfortunately, I turned the lights off on the car so that when I drove into the driveway, they wouldn't see me coming, you know. So there I am, driving down the lane with no lights on. You know, I've tried to do it sober just to see if it's possible, and I couldn't even do it sober, but I was driving down this lane in the car, and the first thing I remember is a blue flashing light behind me. Now, this police car had been coming the other way and thought I was stationary till I passed him. And he sort of, he stopped, pulled over, you know, blue flashing lights on. So I kind of stopped, you know, I was kind of into all this, you know, conforming. And he came to the car and I did the best thing possible. I burst into tears. I told him that the child I was nannying had a heart problem and she's going for an operation. She's probably going to die. And yes, I'd got drunk. And anyway, this poor policeman said, you know, where do you live? And I said, back down there. Can you turn your car around? I said, out it, not in this lane. So he turned my car around for me. He followed me home, came in for a coffee, made sure I was safe, and off he went. Anyway, a couple of nights later, I was out. I went looking for the policeman to tell him about this conviction that was pending. And I found him. He was still on night duty that week. So I found this policeman, and I said to him, what do you think I should do? And I think he'd heard about it, because it was actually happening in his police station. He'd heard about this, you know, woman that was being charged and stuff. So he told me he thought I should tell the truth. So I told this family. They got me a solicitor. I went to court in Bristol, which is where the things were stolen from, and it was all in the front newspaper and all the rest of it. And I got this conviction for theft. So, you know, the shame I was bringing on myself, these things I'd heard about in the rooms, but I never thought stuff like that would be happening to me. But it did. It did. And it didn't stop there. You know, it just carried on and off. Going back to AA, you know, the lady that became my sponsor was Maureen. She was a nurse, and she worked at Stoke Mandeville Hospital. She was a ward sister, and she was a person I'd avoid like the plague. You know, if I was ever in the hospital and I saw Maureen when I was still drinking, I would walk the other way or dash into a ward somewhere, because I just didn't want to face her. And I thought she'd tell everybody. You know, of course she wouldn't, because she was an alcoholic. So I rang her up one day, and I said to her, Maureen, would you be my sponsor? And she said, well, she said, usually people go to meetings and start doing the steps and then get a sponsor. They're not usually still drunk and not coming to meetings. And why don't you come back to the meeting? So I'd go back again. Anyway, eventually, I'd gone through my nurse training by this time, drinking. Never drank before I went on the wards, but every moment off duty, I would drink. And fortunately, at the beginning of my training, I put a lot of hard work in. I did a lot of studying, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have got through the exams at the end. My two best friends were both drinkers. One of them, definitely not an alcoholic, you know, she'd fall over somewhere and that was the end of her for the evening. The other one was like me. We caused havoc. You know, I can remember, I've just met up with a group of nurses I trained with, and there was another one who used to drink. He's not an alcoholic either. He used to have an air rifle, and we'd be using this bloody air rifle in the nurses' home, shooting things in the nurses' home where we'd been drinking at night. I mean, it's just insane, some of the things that we did. I can remember one night in that hospital. I trained at Stoke Mandeville. I'd love to know what happened exactly, because my memory of this night, there was a party. I can remember falling down under a tree, and everybody had dispersed. They'd all gone. They'd obviously couldn't get me up and get me back to the nurses' home. They just left me this time. And I can remember crawling back through the corridors. I clearly remember this, looking up and seeing a night sister looking down on me. I don't remember what was said. I don't remember whether I was reported. I have no idea. There was no backlash from it. But I do remember coming to, you know, I was obviously crawling. I couldn't walk. So I was crawling back through the corridors, because it was the quickest way back to the nurses' home. I would do things like, I had a car by this time, and we'd be in the social club, which is one end of the hospital, and the nurses' home was the other end. And we'd have, you know, competitions to see how many people we could get into the Beetle and on top of the Beetle and on the bonnet of the Beetle, and I could see how many we could actually drive back to the nurses' home. Instead of going through the hospital grounds, which was possible, no, out on the road, round, roundabouts, you know, a couple of roundabouts, back into the nurses' home. I'm just total insanity. When I was nannying, you know, I had the use of the car there, and, you know, this was me. None of us are proud of what we do. I don't have children, but I drove those children when I was drunk. You know, the two children I nannied for. You know, I did everything. I broke every value I ever had. I stole, I lied. You know, I drove drunk. I'm just very lucky I never killed anybody or myself. I'd wake up in the morning, the car would be there. I wouldn't have a clue where I'd been or how I got home, but I knew I must have driven. There were times I'd wake up, I'd got back to the nurse's home. The canteen used to be open with Jimmy Savile in it all night long. and sometimes we'd go and have something to eat, and I'd leave my car at the canteen. I'd wake up, I even reported to the police once, they'd stolen, and it was at the canteen, you know, and we'd walked back to the nurse's home. Didn't even remember I'd left it there, didn't know I'd driven anywhere. So, you know, my life was total chaos. And after I'd qualified, I was living in a flat at the hospital, and I was going out with this guy called Brian. And Brian wasn't an alcoholic, liked to drink, but he certainly wasn't an alcoholic drinker. And he was in the flat one night, and he said to me, you couldn't stop drinking, could you? And Brian didn't know that I'd been to AA on and off for the last 10 years. Didn't know how much I drank. He only knew what I let him see. And it was not what he said. I'd been called to hospital drunk before. I'd all labels put on me, and I'd been full of shame because of my drinking. But it was the look on his face that did it for me that night. And he looked at me with pity, disgust and pity. And I'd been looking at the mirror at that face for 10 years. You know, that disgust, that pity, hating myself, ashamed of myself. I'd got to a stage, I was a smoker when I was drinking, and I'd gotten to a stage that the local news agent was maybe a 5-minute walk from the nurse's home. And I could go to work, and I could put my uniform on, and I could run a ward, and I could speak to the doctors. I had no fear of anything. That uniform was like my protective clothing, if you like. But take that frock off, and I couldn't even go outside the door. I couldn't, I had no confidence. I would change my clothes 3 or 4 times walking to the news agents to buy cigarettes because I didn't look right. Maybe they'd know I was a drinker. Maybe this, maybe that. You know, probably I used to go out looking like a bag lady half the time. But I don't know, because I knew I needed cigarettes, and I just had to somehow get the courage to go to the shop to get the cigarettes. Put the uniform back on, go to work, no problem. So anyway, that night, Brian went home, and I sat down, and something was different that night. You know, I rang the Samaritans again, and I did a good job on the woman on the end, because she said to me, well, dear, anybody with your problems would probably drink. But this time, something had changed for me, and it was lovely to talk to her, and I was very grateful to have somebody in the middle of the night who picked the phone up, because it helped me to get through that night. But what she said didn't matter, because I knew I was an alcoholic and I'd known for a very long time. Trouble was, I couldn't accept it. And she gave me a number to ring. It was Pat from Twyford, Big Pat. I didn't know Big Pat from Adam. But I rang him, and rang him the next morning. I didn't ring him in the middle of the night, which is what I would normally have done, because, you know, I need something and I need it now. I rang him the next morning, and Pat didn't answer the phone. His wife said, oh, he's just popped out, he'll be back, shall I get him to call you? But fuck, you know, because it'd taken so much courage to ring him. Anyway, he rang me back and he said, do you want to stop drinking? And I said, yeah, I do, you know, but this time it was with a difference. This time I was desperate. And this time I'd made my mind up that night that if I didn't make it this time, I was going to kill myself. And it wouldn't have been with drink. I just couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't be these two people in my head. You know, this very reliable, hard-working nurse on the one hand and this nutter on the other. These two just didn't live in my head anymore. I just couldn't do it. So I went back with a difference this time. And I went back, I was prepared to do whatever it took. If my sponsor had said to me, Lynn, you're going to need to stand on your head in that corner for a week and you'll be fine, I would have done it. I would have done anything that I was asked to do. I can remember she gave me the little black book. She took me to Princess Risborough on the Monday night, and then I think I went to Tring on the Tuesday night, but she bought me a little black book at Princess Risborough, and she wrote in it. And I can remember going to a meeting in Oxford and them talking about what it said in the little black book that morning, 24 hours a day book, and it didn't say what I'd read. And Maureen had said to me, you have to read this book every day. Now, I got sober on February the 2nd, but I started reading the book on January the 1st, you know, because I had to read every page, every day. So I was kind of like a month behind everybody else in the 24-hour state. But this is how perfect I wanted my sobriety to be. I wanted to do everything I was told to do. So, you know, when I said, look, do you think I've got a different book? No, he said, they're all the same. you know, the same. I said, well, how can it be? When he showed me what it said on that particular date, I realised I was like a month behind. And duh, you know, this is how stupid I'd been. But anyway, you know, I went to any length then. I went to meetings all the time. I used to get through the day for those meetings, you know, knowing that there'd be a meeting tonight. And I would travel where I needed to go. We used to go, we'd meet up together and four or five of us go to the meetings together. And it was lovely. It was becoming a fantastic way of life. And my confidence grew and I liked the person I was becoming. And I stayed sober. I found out over the years, you know, just how portable sobriety is, because I've been very lucky. You know, I never got married and I don't have children, but I've done an awful lot of travelling in my life. And when I was about 2 years sober, I'd left the hospital, I'd left Stoke Mandeville, because Maureen had said to me, if you stay on that ward, you're going to drink. So I thought, well, I've got to go to another ward. But I felt like a failure because I couldn't work with this ward system. I mean, nobody could work with this ward system, but because I couldn't, I felt like a failure. So I thought, oh no, I've got to leave the hospital. So I went to work for a nursing agency and I did all sorts of different things, you know, but I was going to my meetings, I was staying sober. And then I saw a job advertised in one of the Nursing Times, you know, magazines, they were looking for a nurse in a treatment centre. And I didn't know anything about treatment or treatment centres. I certainly couldn't afford to go to treatment, and I just didn't know that they, you know, didn't know anything about them. But I applied for the job, and this nurse rang me, and she said, do you know about 12-step fellowships? And I was like, well, yeah, I know a bit. She said, okay. Anyway, she arranged an interview for me, and I made up my mind, if I liked her, I'd tell her the truth. I was in recovery, because I didn't think they'd employ people like me in recovery. I certainly wouldn't have told the National Health Service that I was a recovering alcoholic, that's for sure. So anyway, I went along for the interview and I liked Helen, and she said, is there somebody in your family then that's in the 12-step? I said, no, actually it's me. And it was like, wow, that's fantastic. We haven't got a nurse on the staff at the moment who's in recovery. Fuck, put it on the CV. I thought, this is, you know, this is amazing. This is something to be, you know, wow, it's got me in here. So I started working in a treatment centre, and I then went off to train as a therapist and worked in different hospitals. I went to work in one hospital, and the owner had a boat, you know, and I loved sailing. I'd taken up sailing in recovery. And he had this big wooden boat. She was amazing. And I knew that if I went to work there, I'd get the chance to sail on Irene. So, you know, sure enough, I did. It was written into my contract that if they needed a cook, I'd be relieved from my nursing duties at the clinic to go off sailing. So I went off for 3 or 4 months on this boat, and we went to France and we did a wooden boat show and stuff like that. Of course, when I came back, I couldn't settle back in the clinic. So I went off on another boat, and this one was headed for India. I was going to be, you know, cook crew on a boat going to India, a yacht. So the skipper, I think if I'd stayed on there, one of us would have died. You know, he was a dodgy skipper, to say the least, and very scary sailing with him. You know, the kind of things that happened were awful. So we got to Gibraltar, and I thought, I can't do this anymore. I got off in Gibraltar. And that's what sobriety's given me. It's given me, you know, the ability to face up to things and make sensible decisions. So I got off in Gibraltar, and of course, first thing I had to do was find an AA meeting, because I didn't know anybody in Gibraltar. So I met this guy called Harris, who I'm still friends with today. And he introduced me to a bloke called David. David was actually driving back because he was going to the Blue Bonnets. So he said, do you want to come to the Blue Bonnets, you know, instead of getting a flight back? Yeah. So, you know, I came back from Gibraltar, didn't get to India, but I came back from Gibraltar, went to the Blue Bonnets. First time I'd been to that convention. It was just like, blew me away. Amazing. And David's dead now, bless him, but Harris is still alive. We're still in touch. I've been out many times and stayed in Gibraltar, you know, and go to meetings there and stuff. Then I didn't want to go back to working as a nurse. I ended up in Mexico for 7 months, working on a boat in Mexico. And again, I found AA. And there was this thing, we used to go on the Ness every morning. So the cruisers, you know, on these yachts around, we'd always get in touch like 10 o'clock in the morning. We'd have this net call. So everybody, so you couldn't really talk AA stuff. But there was one guy who owned a yacht who was on the net every morning, who was in AA. I'd mess him at meetings. So I met this little group of people, and I used to go to meetings when we were ashore. Every time we were back in the paths, I'd go off to meetings, and I'd met a load of people doing that. Came back to the UK, went back to work in another treatment centre. And, you know, I've been very lucky. I've sailed as volunteer nurse on tour ships for many years, so I've done many transatlantic. So we'd be at sea for maybe 16, 17 days. We'd get to Barbados or somewhere. I'd have already looked up the meetings. And as soon as the gangplank was down, I was off, you know, going to a meeting. And I can remember the captain, where the fuck is she going? You know, we haven't even cleared customs yet. And I'd sort of run off. I was now a legal immigrant in Barbados because I was running off to an AA meeting. And when I got back, where have you been? I went to an, you know, they know I'm an alcoholic, so, you know, they knew it was fine. But I did go as an illegal immigrant and sort of got into trouble for that. But I met lots of people doing that. And most recently, for the last 9 or 10 years, I was on a transatlantic once, and I was a bit bored with these things now, you know, like, I've done about 8 or 9 transatlantics on tour ships, and on one of the trips, you know, you read everything you can find, because you're at sea, you run out of newspapers, you read everybody else's newspaper and magazines. There was an engineers magazine, and they were looking for engineers to work on medical boats in the Amazon. So I thought, well, if it's a medical boat, they've probably got nurses. So when I got home, I looked that up, and they did indeed have nurses that went out. So then I started going out as a volunteer to the Peruvian Amazon, and they're little tugboats that were donated by the British Navy. And, you know, it's just an amazing thing. And my relationship with God was very good, but on that first trip, something else changed for me. And it's a very Christian organisation, and it was a bit like, whoa, when I first got there, because it was very Christian. And they had a prayer meeting every day, and it was like, you know. Anyway, the first night I was on board, I didn't go to the prayer meeting. I'm deaf, and I didn't even know the prayer meeting was on. So the next day, the doctor said to me, you didn't come last night. Come where? You know, it's only a small boat. He said, we have a prayer meeting, you know, you come. So I went that next night, and I met these two dentists who I'm still friendly with today, Steve and Liz. And something happened. You know, my relationship with God has always been very strong. But something happened that night on that boat, and I had to walk away from that prayer meeting when it was over. Something touched me inside that I didn't know what was going on emotionally. And Liz came to my cabin, and I was sobbing by that time. And we talked a lot about Christianity, and I'm still not, you know, as strong with that. You know, it's not religion for me, but it is my relationship with God. And something different happened. What I saw with those people, they don't have a program to live by. They are Christians, and that's their program. But they don't just talk it. You know, the love and the passion I saw within these people reaching out to the total poverty in the middle of the Amazon. You know, people that had nothing, no shoes on their feet, no nappies for their babies. It was something that I'd never seen before, that kind of poverty. And, you know, the love that they showed to these people who were, you know, they didn't have much themselves, the people I was working with, the Peruvian people I was working with, but the people in the villages had even less than them. I can remember the first time I went to that village, and I saw this little girl, and she was pulling a piece of string with a plastic bag on the end of it, and that was her toy. But she was so proud, because nobody else had one, you know. This was like an amazing thing. And that opened up my heart and something else, you know, much more deeply inside. I've been to, you know, a meeting in Lima on my way back from there. And I just feel very lucky and very, very grateful for some of the things that have happened in my life. None of this would have been possible if I hadn't found this fellowship and managed to stop drinking a day at a time. You know, I moved to Ireland for 7 years, and I still think it's the worst thing I ever did was coming back here. I felt like an immigrant when I came back to this country. You know, my heart is in Ireland. I'd never lived there before, although both my parents were Irish. But I just loved it. I lived in County Wicklow, and I loved the meetings there, and I loved the people there, and I don't know what it was. I know God knows, you know, why I came back. In some ways, you know, January 2012 was when I came back to the UK, and I had all my medical checks done in January. And because of the recession, I was there when the bailout happened. There was a chance I probably wouldn't have had another mammogram for 2 or 3 years. And when I came back to this country, purely by accident, I saw the consultant. My sister had had breast cancer. And the consultant said to me, you don't need a mammogram for another 18 months. I said, fine, anyway. They sent me an appointment in the post, and I thought, you know, do these people not talk to each other? So I didn't go for the appointment. And then I got another appointment a few weeks later saying, you know, you really should do this. I went, and my breast cancer was picked up. It was obviously very early on, because in Dublin I hadn't got breast cancer in the January. So in November I was diagnosed with breast cancer. This is 5 years ago. And sometimes I think, you know, coming back to this country, had I not come back, if that was God's plan for me, you know, that I had to come back here to save my life, well, you know, okay, I'll put up with being back in England. And, you know, I was treated successfully, and that was fine. Other things, you know, since I've been back job-wise, I've had some horrendous times. I was suspended from a job. I was back working in addictions. I was a treatment manager of one of the priories. And I was working with this team of girls who were not the nicest people. They made some very serious allegations against me. I was suspended from work on full pay for 7 months. My current employer was jubilant when he'd heard what happened to me, because he said, well, you know, you've got a job with us any time, so, you know, come and work for me again. But that was harrowing, because I can remember the day I wanted to be a nurse. I was 10 years old. I was visiting my dad in hospital, and I can remember his respect for the nurses, and I can remember thinking, I want to do that. That's what I want to be when I grow up. And so to get my registration was so important to me. And the fact that, you know, I nearly lost 3 years it took me to fight this, you know, going to the NMC, to all sorts of stuff. I had an amazing barrister through the Royal College of Nursing, you know, my union. And when I look back on it, I could see that, you know, the panel of nurses that investigate all of this, they were, you know, I read all the scripts afterwards of the case, and I could see that they were very, very supportive to me, very much on my side. But when I was in it, I couldn't see that. I really thought I was going to lose my registration. I was full of fear again. But I had this programme, and I used to go to meetings, and I used to share. And no matter what's been thrown at me, I know, you know, with God and with the fellowship and the people in these rooms, working my programme, I can deal with anything. You know, there's nothing that's going to come along. I can remember when I was a couple of months sober, Wick, and some people may have known Wick at Beaconsfield, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and I can remember him sharing it and thinking to myself, with 2 months sobriety under my belt, what a waste, you know, because all those years of sobriety that man's got, and he's going to get drunk now. Because I couldn't imagine somebody be giving that diagnosis and not drinking. You know, why would you not? If you were going to die anyway, you may as well drink. That was my thinking with two months sobriety under my belt. But of course he didn't drink, and that was the first sober funeral I ever went to. And, you know, when I was diagnosed, it never even occurred to me to pick a drink up. And it never occurred to me to pick a drink up when I went through that stuff with the NMC. And it's never occurred to me to pick up a drink for so long now. You know, I just feel so eternally grateful for that. I know I'm as at risk as the next person because I have alcoholism. And I've seen people go back out there after years of sobriety, and I don't want to be one of those people. I want what I've got, and I want more of it. And I know that the only way that my life improves today is by me working this programme and facing up when I do things wrong and when I'm, you know, not being the nicest person I can be. I know it today, and I have to do something about that. I have to take personal responsibility for myself, and I can't leave that up to anybody else. That's down to me. You know, it's my journey. It's my recovery. Both my parents saw me sober before they died. My dad used to say to me, but you're not a real alcoholic, are you? You know, his idea of an alcoholic was somebody on a park bench. There were days I'd wake up with my shoes on in my bed and my clothes still fully clothed. And yeah, I'd go for a walk in the park and I'd see those park bench drunks and I'd think to myself, with children running around, that's awful, that's disgusting, really. You know, what was the difference between them and me? The only difference was I had a roof over my head. I was doing all that in my own home, waking up in my clothes, waking up, you know, in a mess, not knowing what I'd done, There was no difference, and there still is no difference today. You know, I'm still that person. I'm just one of the lucky ones that found this program, and, you know, and have had so much love and help from the people in this program all over the world. You know, it's like, isn't it amazing? We've got this illness. Wherever we go in the world, we can find a meeting with people who get us. As soon as we walk in the door, they may not even speak the same language, but they know me, because I wouldn't be in there if I hadn't got alcoholism. And they're only in there because they've got alcoholism. And so all the differences are irrelevant, you know, because the similarity is we've all suffered the pain of this illness and we've all come through it, you know, today. So I think, you know, we're the luckiest people alive. So many of us don't make it. And I've, you know, working in treatment centres, I've seen so many deaths. Young people who don't make it. Young people that don't do what's suggested. And I know treatment isn't the answer. It puts them on their journey. But if they don't do this fellowship afterwards, their chances are less than average, you know. And or they may live dry drunk for the rest of their lives. I don't want that for me. I don't want it for them. But it's not my recovery. You know, mine is mine and theirs is theirs. And so we can only sort of like suggest. But I love this programme. You know, I love the people in this programme. It's taught me tolerance. It's taught me how to be happy. It's taught me to let go of shame. It's taught me to let go of guilt. It's taught me I'm responsible. And I am responsible. I'm responsible to this programme and I'm responsible for my recovery in this programme. And I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Lynn. Right, it was easy yesterday, mate. His wife finished, didn't they? Clap for you. You with me? You know. I think what you shared there and about the background and about that nurse's uniform. I come in away, and I could always care for people, right? And but my feeling was no one could love me. It was a missing link in me, you know. It's Arena, might be anyone in the room. Jimmy A used to say to me, he says, you know, he says, you've got the missing link, son. He said, not just in there, he used to say to me, in here as well, you know. And I just felt like, well, perhaps you just give out to people, and you might help someone out. And, but AA gets you, doesn't it? You know, it's like your man there, you with me, the night when he jumped up in the meeting, you know, he might not remember. It's like I've just gone through a tough time, you know, and, I've been saying, you know, I've this crusade in my head, right? When I go away, I just want to keep quoting the last two messages of Dr. Bob and Bill W. One's about anonymity, and the other one's about gossip, isn't it? You know, and I'm thinking, just like Terry with the gut, keep it quiet, right? And when I got the cancer, and it was diagnosed and everything like that, you know, because it had come so quick with the other what I had, you know, I knew inside me that I wasn't angry. But no one else has to know that, are they? You know, some things are only you know, isn't it, inside, you know? And there's people over that meeting at Beaconsfield that I still feel like I'm on the outside. I like to be on the outside of things. I like to be in charge with me. You know, you lot are there and I'm over it and don't poke your nose sort of thing, you know? And, you know, Sonia, the woman that's been sober a long time, you know, well, because I don't broadcast it, and a few times she's come over to me and Ricky Ann and Mary Ann, you know, and they just pulled me to one side. Well, I don't think these people even noticed me. I get in under the radar, like your man sitting out there, Bill, he's another one, you know, he's coming in a minute, you know. And when they come up to you, and they, you know, I'm used to everything. But when people come up to you and they remember your name, they burn it out, how are you coping? How are you really doing? You know, oh, I'm so scared I'm going to cry. You hear me? I'm so frightened, you know, and I'm lost for words. And I think, no, you've got to feel this. You've got to feel this, Bernard, because there's a long time out there where it's just darkness, isn't it? You know, you've got to be brave enough now to feel this love now, because you don't know, you might be waking up every morning at 3 o'clock in the morning and just out of darkness of the soul. And if you ain't got people who've made that, if you're pushing the presence of AA or God, as Terry said, you push people away. You're pushing the presence of God away with the darkness, it's, isn't it? You know, and it's like your message there. You know, that line where you said when you looked at—I'm not going to go on—but I so identify that bit where we're almost conditioned that we're going to hell, ain't we? In a handcart, you with me? You know, and it's like, you know, you didn't think you'd get away with it, did you? You know what I mean? Now life's got you. You with me? They're going to strike you off, and that cowboy program with Brandy, you with me? They like, take the thing and break the sword and make him, you know. And as I have the courage to actually see, this is what AA has given me, to actually see the courage, people do care. You know, I let like a lot of people say it's dog eat dog. Yeah, I don't buy into that really. I've known some hard busters, be some the kindest people you can meet, and some of the so-called nicest people can be the meanest son of so and so you could ever meet. You know, but a very powerful message. You know, and like you said, looking at them notes, and I don't know, you know, and to turn off, actually these people, you know, I owe a lot to other people. AA loved me long before I even give a toss about me. It's just like, Bernie, you got to go out and take so-and-so to a meeting. For fuck's sake. It's like this old time suit. We don't want this. It's the smallest group in Reading. We don't want it. From the first day we've done it, we've made money, right? So that means we've made money. God's will is you've got to put the money in for the next one. You with me? And it's, you know, and then I'm going around. I don't want to do this, right? I don't want to be up here. I don't want to do none of it. But it's the same old pattern of AA. What you don't think is good for you is good for you. And all the things that I thought were good for me,
yeah,
don't pay out, do it. Yeah. You know, and so if I've been, other people have suggested this. So just for, if you haven't got nothing, don't worry. But there is a tradition 7 there, because people say it's important that we mention tradition 7. So I'm just mentioning there's a tradition 7 bucket. But if you ain't got it, don't worry. And so we'll be back for Art Bus 2, yeah? And so we, I don't know, what do we do now? Do you have another clap and close it, yeah? Oh, no. Oh, we might say Serenity Prayer. Sorry. Yeah. See, the pressure up there. See, the wonderful thing is, because we're all over 30 years, majority, there's no judgment, is there? You with me? Everyone's, they're all cuddling me, aren't they? So, who can we, will you say the Serenity Prayer? Okay.
Would you join me in the Serenity Prayer using the God, word God as you do or don't understand him, her? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Keep coming back.
Well, you're doing really well. It's good.
Thank you for asking.
No, it's lovely.
Thank you, young lady.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn, darling.
Thanks, Eddie.
Yeah,
we'll keep in touch. Yes. More, all right? Yeah, yeah, okay. So, yeah, 26 area, I didn't know.
So we do that then, I'll go and bring you back.
1992.
So I met this lady who's a Facebook.
Yeah, it's a link.